Accession number 27060, reel 11.
This is the sixth reel of a taped interview with Bill Stacey in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 28th of the 4th or 5th, 2004, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Bill, you were talking about the bombardment that you were involved with in relation to WEWAC. Can we continue you telling us of the experience that you had of the WEWAC campaign?
Yeah, well, the campaign was fought in a different manner to any other war that the Australians or anybody else had ever been in, because of the terrain, the mountainous terrain that was so effective in defence, so that every time that our infantry planned an attack, the Japs were already in occupation of the adjacent ridges. So the plan evolved over a short period of time that the infantry would go in, make contact, and then the artillery would come in, and on odd occasions aircraft would come in and bomb the bomb and shell the area until it was considered safe for the infantry to go in and then clean up. And in apparently, from what I've read and talked to infantry soldiers, the method was very effective, because it drove the Japs, just went to the next hill and occupied it and dug in, and then it was just a succession of bombardments, advances, bombardments, advances, until they reached their objectives. But all in all, extremely difficult areas to use artillery. The gullies have always seemed to run in the wrong direction for their line of fire, and which made it the FO's, the forward observation officer's job's very, very difficult, you know. And
you're mentioning the guns that you had experienced that would come out of tunnels that had been built by the Japanese and
yeah,
retire.
Well,
what of the actual resistance?
The infantry tries three or four times to dig these Japanese out of this particular area where they had where they finally found out the reason why they couldn't attack, didn't get the gun, was that they were running it into a tunnel in the hill and then running it out and firing and going back in. And in the final analysis, the infantry attacked the gunners, got onto the what's the name, and they destroyed the gun, and reports afterwards said that the casualties were extremely heavy on the Japanese side. They just caught them at the right time, apparently. The gun was a great nuisance, because there was no pattern of firing. They'd fire and then they'd go away, and then maybe 24 hours and they'd wheel it out and have another go. So, and it was very heavily defended. They apparently put a great deal of stock on their gun, because they defended it greatly, you know, every inch.
You'd spoken about the way the Japanese were single-mindedly difficult to deal with.
Yeah.
Any examples, specific examples that you can give of this particular?
Well, I don't know whether I told you about them coming down onto the yam plantations. I told you that, I think,
yeah.
Didn't I? Yeah. Well, but they used to sneak around of a night time, and I suppose they're to be congratulated. The second machine gun battalion, I think they actually stuffed wire down their or attempted to stuff wire down the radiators on their guns. You know, that's how close they were coming in. But as I said before, all under instructions. They done exactly what they were told to do. And
fight to the last.
That's right, yeah. Even in when we had them in cages, in compounds, after the surrender, the big fellas, the Suma brigades. I don't know whether they were Koreans or part, or they were big people. And if anybody said anything to them, they'd want to come out and fight, even when they were in captivity. You know, they're aggressive all the time. But not all of them. They were the particular ones, but some of the others were only too pleased to get out of it, you know. They were that ridden with beriberi and disease that it must have been a terrible life for them too in the jungle with nowhere to go and no prospects at all, you know.
How was your life in New Guinea, your average day, your camp, day-to-day routine?
It was sort of a go-go-go campaign. It was you're never very static. You're on the move all the time. There's always something to do, something extra needed. And of course, with the quick advances that they made, the gunners were either filling sandbags for gun pits or digging gun pits, and they wouldn't be there for very long, and they'd be up and away, and so it went on, you know.
But
terrible country for artillery, because a lot of it was swampy, and when the guns dug themselves in, if it wasn't for the fact that the 25 pounder had a platform that had run around, I don't know what they would have done. In the old 18 pounder would have dug itself up into the wood, down to the wheels.
You were talking about the guns previously, and I'm interested in discussing the sort of day-to-day routine, and you mentioned not much rest.
No.
So can you tell us what your camp was like?
Oh, very rudimentary. Like, the gunners lived in the gun pits, and they used to just have set up cane stretchers type things, or sleep on the ground. A lot of the cooking was done on primuses, individually, you know.
Had you had a gutful of the war by this stage?
Yeah, well, as far as I was, me personally concerned, at the end I'd had enough. And when they surrendered, it was the greatest thing that ever happened to me, because I just had the horrors. It's bloody been there and done that and long enough, and it was just dragging out and dragging out and dragging out. And
well, let's talk about your experience of WEWAC. What did you see of WEWAC once it had been defended?
I didn't see any part of the town at all. It was just plantations as we went up through. The German apparently had a lot of plantations of coconut farms all the way up, which the Japanese had these small axes, and they used to chop the coconut palms down to block the roadway, and I got out of an axe and it hit the palm and it bounced off. It was just like steel. So how in the bloody hell they used to cut them down with these lightweight axes they had, I'll never know. But that's what they used to do. And of course, after the war, the copra companies claimed compensation for the number of trees that were cut down, you know, or blown down, or whatever. It seemed ridiculous to me. But the road was very basic, right on the water, or 90% of the way, because the mountains come so down so close to the shoreline, you know, and the rivers is beside the big ones like the Drinamore and the Danmab and there's a couple of others. The engineers were forever building bridges, you know, and most of our transport used to put grease all over the exposed parts and drive through the rivers with them, you know, with extended exhaust pipes and that sort of thing. But every time it rained up in the hills, might be miles away, the rivers would wash the bridges out, and they had to start all over again. You go across the river in the morning, and and on the way in, it'd be knee-deep, and you come back in the afternoon, it'd be up around your shoulders. Matter of fact, one of my little Tommy, he was shorter than me, and he started to drift away, and I grabbed him by the hair, and the next couple of steps we got on higher ground, otherwise the Dranmab would have shoved him out to sea, you know. But you're continually wet, either with the rain or in the river,
You mentioned that the morale was still pretty good, but I would have thought that being wet constantly...
Yeah, but morale was very good, you know. They accepted it was what you had to do, that was the point, you know. No good of saying, oh, this is no good, get out of here. You don't. You put up with and do your best under the circumstances that you've got. You know, that's your job. But as I said, I was pleased when it was over. That stage of the game, in 6 years, I'd had enough. And
what was the situation then, on the coming of the end of your involvement? The coastal forces began their assault on Wee-Wak in early May of 45.
Yeah, May, June, July, August, yeah.
Following an attack by the 2nd 4th Battalion from the 19th Brigade, assisted by tanks, on the 11th of May.
Yeah, right.
Do you recall any of that?
Yeah, I don't. The tanks weren't used very much there. There wasn't any scope for them, really. But they were used on odd occasions, but it was mostly infantry, artillery. You know, because when it's all said and done, it's the people that occupy the territory that win the war. Doesn't matter what you've got, artillery or bombs or tanks, it's those people on the ground that ultimately get the final result. So it was really an infantry man's war because it was so individual.
When the campaign was over, and we'd spoken in passing about this, the Australians being given a sort of secondary duty in relation to the larger... war at that time.
Yeah.
What were your personal feelings in relation to what had been achieved and that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, we always thought that the job was there to be done and we were allotted to do it, so we done it, you know. I don't think the politics come into with the troops very much at all. It was just that was the job they were sent there to do and that's what they done. And they've got no control. They had no control on what the ultimate desires of the hierarchy were. They were just there to do what they were told. But I suppose in a way it was... we had our hands fairly well full anyway. We couldn't have... what would have been the alternative? Just to walk out and leave the Japs where they were and let them do what they like and us go on another campaign. I mean, somebody had to be there. But unfortunately, or fortunately, it was us. But I don't know whether it was absolutely necessary to attack the Japanese the way they did. Maybe if they'd have just penned them in and kept them where they were, and they would have saved lives that way. But
what do you recall of May the 8th, 45, VE Day?
We were delayed a bit because... Adachi would not surrender unless he got permission from a higher authority. So,
but that would be later on. The victory in Europe.
Oh, in Europe.
Yeah.
Oh, great. You know.
What do you recall of that occasion?
Just what we got over the wireless. Like we only got what the SIGs used to get from the wirelesses. You know, we didn't have any. Then our aircraft, our Qantas, I think it was, used to fly by and drop some newspapers later on, which was great. You know, it would be a big scramble if they were flying supplies in, and as they went over where they thought there was Australian soldiers, they'd drop a few newspapers. It's called the newspaper run at the finish, and it was a great thing to get hold of the papers and find out what was going on. But other than the papers... we used to get skimpy communiques and that sort of thing, but everybody was great. It was great for everybody, especially in in my unit, because it meant that all our comrades that had been captured were finally released, you know. We didn't catch up with any of them until after the war was finished, after the Jap War was finished, you know.
What was it like then? You mentioned trying to get a Dutchie to...
Well, he hadn't, his batteries and all his wirelesses were down, gone, and so he wouldn't surrender, so we sent a big snooper set in for him to use, and he got in touch with Singapore, and they gave him permission to surrender, otherwise he would have had to commit hara-kiri, you know. And that once he got permission from a higher authority, well, that saved his face, and he didn't have to do it, you know. Then they drummed up a big parade, and the division marched past, and the Japanese surrenders. I've got photos of the surrender, of him actually handing his sword over, you know. And, still an upright, small man, but upright. And
well, tell us a little bit about that occasion and what that involved and what you recall of the people that were there.
Well, a certain number from each unit that was available, they didn't pull everybody out of the hills and that, but they formed up in a sort of hollow square, and Hitachi come down out of they flew him in on the Borum airstrip, I think it was, and they flew him in, and he came up to the table, marched him and his aide under guard, came up to his table, and one of our generals was there, or three or four of our generals, one in particular, and he just got his sword in both hands and handed it to the general. The general took it, saluted, both saluted, and that was it, you know, that was the final surrender.
How did the average soldier see hierarchy at this time?
Yeah, well, one of the things that we had a big disturbance about was that it wasn't the army, it was the politicians putting pressure on the army that they wanted to limit the number of rounds that could be fired a day, you know, down to 50 rounds a day in some cases, and the gunners start to grumble and rumble, and our CO communicated the men's feelings, and a politician came up there and got howled down something dreadful, and the next thing we know that all the restrictions are lifted, and there was what their idea was of conserving ammunition at that stage of the war, nobody will ever know. Just, you know, they must have had big stockpiles of it in Australia and nowhere else to use it, so they might as well let them fire off as many as they could. But my unit put a Japanese surrender, they put a barrage of star shells up over the sea, and then they fired a Southern Cross in star shells. That was the finish of the campaign.
That was on VJ Day.
VJ Day.
What was the knowledge of how the end of the war for the Japanese had come about?
Well, we heard on the grapevine that they'd dropped the two atomic bombs, and that the Japanese immediately saw the writing was on the wall, you know.
Being a gunner, did you understand what an atomic bomb
was? Oh, yeah, we did. We really did. We discussed it, you know, how, although our knowledge was only rudimentary, we understood that, you know, the devastation of a naval gun, and that would only be infinitesimal in comparison to an atomic bomb. You know, they killed thousands of people, and worst of all, it maimed thousands of them for the rest of their lives. It was not a thing that I don't think the average Australian approved of. I really don't. But it was a way of winning the war without killing any more Americans. That was the point about it. It was so. It's not a means to an end, but it served its purpose. But not a great deal of acceptance in my unit anyway. I can't speak for the others, but it was discussed pretty openly, and and they thought there would have been a better way than... I think that every soldier, I really think this, is that every soldier really dislikes the involvement of civilians in the in his war, in his campaign. He hates it because they can't do anything to help themselves. There's nothing they can do. You know, the soldier's got there to defend himself or kill the other people. The population's just wide open to everything that happens, you know. In New Guinea, I think that the New Guinea population was a bit two ways, you know. If the Aussies were in control, they worked for the Aussies, and I think they done a fair bit for the Japs too, because the Japs would have assimilated more with the population than what the Australians did or would have. Not that we ever come in contact with any vast numbers of people. The only people we, my unit, ever contacted were Papuan infantry and boys that were doing the porterage, you know. But, we, as far as our artillery unit was concerned, we carried all our own gear, all around wireless signals, all our wire for our telephones. That we carried that ourselves. We didn't have any portage at all, you know.
The war's over now. How did that sort of hit home?
Well, it's a sort of it's a euphoria for a while, and then everybody sort of says, "Now what?" You know, what especially the originals that had been, you know, militarized for 6 years. That's all they knew. The people standing next door was the only person they knew. And in the case of my unit, like in 6 years, we had two lots of 14 days leave at home. You know, we used to get weekend leave when we were in the Middle East when we weren't in action. But, you know, at home in Sydney, at home in Australia, I had one lot of 7 days and one lot of 14 days in 6 years, which makes you a sort of a semi-stranger when you arrive home. You've got to take up what threads you do have and start to knit the garment again. It's not an easy transformation either, because the things that you took for granted that you knew were there, they're not there anymore, and you're the one that's got to make all the pace, you're the one that makes the decisions, you're the one that, you know, provides.
Well, I get the impression that you sort of come home and there's a sense of letdown given what you've been involved with.
Yeah, I don't know about letdown. I thought we were proud of our efforts. But
the fact that you mentioned, well, that's it. Okay, yeah. War's over. Thanks,
yeah,
boys.
Yeah, well, what's next? Yeah, see you later. And the funny thing, that division, Australian 6th Division, and my unit, we dissipated 50 by 20 and 10 and 10 and never ever paraded anywhere. Nobody ever said good on you. And we just went into the distance and that was it, you know. And a lot of people were disappointed about that. They thought that the 6th Division was the major division that had the biggest campaigns, that they could have at least paraded them in a couple of the big cities or something. I believe the 9th Division had a parade, but the 6th Division was never, ever on parade as a unit. And even now they talk about it, you know. And there's not many of them left.
How about coming home and being expected to fit into civilian life?
Yeah, well, that's what I said. It's not the easiest of things, because where everything was organisation, you're the organisation. You've got to provide, you've got to decide what you and your wife or what you and your family are going to do. And then you've got to go. I was lucky. I went back to the job that I started with, and a lot of people didn't. You know, a lot of people didn't go back. That there was a really downgrade for a while.
Did you know people that just couldn't cope with the idea?
Yeah, I do. I could never. get on the grog and stay on the grog, and couldn't come to grips with. I think there was a lot more than what I knew too. Most of them made a success. I think that in most cases the army done more good to the men than it done harm.
Well, I was going to ask.
It gave them a sense of responsibility. It gave them the sense to know what their priorities were. And when a job had to be done, it had to be done, irrespective of whether sometimes it wasn't too good, but you'd done it. And I think that transferred into civilian life, because most of the people that I know personally and have kept contact with over the years have all been very successful or fairly successful, and I would say better than average successful, all the ones that I know, you know. That's because I don't suppose that happens in all cases, but still.
Well, I was going to talk to you about the way the war had sort of educated you in a human way. What had you taken away as the strengthening sort of aspect to your personality, that the way humans could be, the way you would actually fit into humanity now?
I think the basic thing in all those things is discipline and the sense of obligation. You know, there are certain things you can do and certain things you can't do, and to accept the things that you should do and turn your life into something worthwhile. I mean, people have got to have objectives. They've got to have goals to work to. Otherwise, there's no point in anything. And we all know that nothing's forever, but still, even in that light, you've still got to have that goal of that point of achievement. And I think that the army set you up for that, you know, because whatever you've done, you had an objective. It didn't matter what it was.
You'd seen extremes of life.
That's right.
How did that experience?
Well, I think it matures you more. You're inclined to accept the things that are impossible to change, and to attempt to change the things that are possible to change.
People talk of, and it was mentioned earlier on in the interview, the war to end all wars was the First World War. What was the second?
Well, I think that was the war to end all world wars, the second. That's exactly. And I don't want to philosophise, but when it's all boiled down, who wins? Who wins? Wars are not made for people. People only carry them out. And people are the end results. People get killed. The people that are up the top that are making all the money with the munitions and land grabbing and who's got the oil and who's having... they don't lose. When it all goes away, they're still up on top with more power, and the ordinary fellow's mourning his son or his father or whatever, and the civilians are mourning the kids that were killed. But they're not the winners. It's only the people that crave power get done when they get beaten, and the people that win that crave power, they get more power, and that's the way the world goes, and I don't think that we're about to change it.
Well, obviously we had things like the Cold War and Korean War and Malaya and Vietnam, and we've had Timor and Iraq. When you see all of those events, all of those conflicts, and you look back at your time in the Second World War, what do you think?
I think, what's the point? You know, it's only a repetition of what's going on. Nobody ever learns anything. And it's still the people that get injured. And it's, people don't, you put people together, they're not worried about whether somebody's got an oil field or whether they haven't got an oil field. If you let them go, they'll live their lives on their social scale that they're in. Like, look at India, you know. India, before the British got to it, they had all their levels of society. And those people lived in their levels of society and enjoyed their levels of society because they had an objective to move up the social scale when they died. So that was the greatest controlling factor that anybody's ever invented, in my opinion. It's like communism. Communism is the greatest thing that ever was, but it doesn't work. Because you can't, if you sat 10 people down and give them $10 each, and give them 2 days, two of the fellas would have the whole lot, and the rest, or somebody would, it's just the sort, the strive to get power, in my opinion. Money, after a certain period, money doesn't make any difference. It's just the power that comes with the money that they get, you know. And the more they get, the more power they want.